You are listening to Mind Over Matters here on KEXP 90.3 FM Seattle. It is 8:30, and we have here in the studios with us once again Joff Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to both of you.
Hello.
It is morning, isn't it?
It is. And we're all
yeah, the sun's up.
We figured between the three of us, we've got about 8 hours of sleep total.
Yeah, exactly. It's a well-rested kind of morning. So if we're rambling incoherently, you'll know that, well,
we're, or more than usual.
More than usual. More than usual. If we're rambling incoherently, you'll know we're back in our usual groove. So.
So getting things rolling, the Counterspin was talking about stuff from the free trade area of the Americas, which wasn't catching any local coverage.
Yeah, and I just wanted to add parenthetically to that. I mean, they certainly covered a lot of it in terms of really the almost complete media blackout on the demonstrations in Quito and the anti-globalization movement. But there's also been a blackout on the larger trend of South America really just not wanting a whole lot to do with either the Bush administration or the IMF, World Bank sort of global globalization neoliberal agenda. You had massive demonstrations in Ecuador last week with the FTAA meetings there. You had Lula being elected president in Brazil a couple weeks ago. And you have had all of this going on in the context of a number of other developments in the past couple of years of Venezuela, of Peru, of Bolivia,
Argentina,
where in almost all of the countries on the continent you've had in one or another context a pretty explicit rejection of that agenda, number one, and number two, that it's been very, very grassroots. It's involved massive street demonstrations. It has not really come from the political elites of the countries. And in many ways, these countries are practicing democracy a lot more effectively than we are. And when we get to the election wrap up, we can talk a little more about that. But there's, number one, an awful lot for activists in this country to learn about what's going on in South America right now. And then, again, if we're talking about Bush administration foreign policy and how the U.S. is perceived in the rest of the world, this is a massive, massive story about this is not the end of history by any means, that we now have this one monolithic sort of corporate trade structure and economic structure that's going to take over the world. An awful lot of people don't want to see that, and that's very much contested terrain that people in this country aren't hearing about.
Yeah, a lot of people doing something about it.
Yep, here and elsewhere.
All right. Well, this week we've been, at least those who follow it, have been watching for several weeks now the UN, and watching the UN slowly try and pass these different versions of Iraq resolution.
Yeah, speaking of the United States and how it's perceived in the rest of the world.
Right, yeah, the UN, the UN yesterday voted on and passed 15-0, the UN Security Council, I mean, passed 15-0 the U.S. resolution for inspections in Iraq. And interestingly enough, I mean, I kind of view this as not really the U.S.'s resolution anymore because it's gone through so many drafts and changes. Interestingly enough, it's being portrayed in the U.S. media as a major victory for Bush that he got this thing passed. I mean, you'd have to set the bar so low that an infant could crawl over it for it to be a victory for Bush. I'm not kidding. This, in this version of the resolution, France got everything they asked for, including a two-resolution solution, which was the initial proposal by the French representative, that this resolution only be a resolution for inspections in Iraq, and if there are problems with that, then the inspectors would come back to the Security Council and they would debate a second resolution as to what would be done about that. That's exactly what this resolution covers, and it's exactly what the French representative had asked for. Russia got everything it asked for, including a guarantee from the U.S. that if there is regime change in Baghdad, that there would not be an increase in oil production that would drop the price of oil. That's the one thing that Russia had really been concerned about. And essentially, there is, you know, they've pulled all the teeth out of the resolution. The U.S. cannot unilaterally decide that Iraq has violated any UN resolutions and then go to war with them. the U.S. cannot decide to strike at any time until the Security Council has debated the issue. So essentially, this bears no resemblance. I mean, they've even removed the provision that the U.S. or the U.N. would send armed troops in to accompany the inspectors. I mean, all of the things that the U.S. really pushed for are gone from this resolution. So I can't see this as a victory for Bush. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, and a couple more things just on the sort of media portrayal of this in the U.S. media over the past 24 hours. One is that all of those details are very, very important. So is the fact that we're even talking about the Security Council at all. It was the original Bush administration
exactly.
position that the United Nations didn't matter, that we just go charging ahead and all of our coalition partners would tag along because that's what obedient coalition partners always do, and we'll bribe them enough and we'll pay them enough money and oil concessions and foreign loans and military hardware that they'll all come happily along. Well, the rest of the world didn't. And between the international pressure, and I think domestic pressure and politics had something to do with it too, and Colin Powell and the opposition of a number of people at the Pentagon and within the administration, the Bush administration had to go to the United Nations in the first place. That was the first defeat. And then the second defeat is the actual resolution that has been passed. That's one item. The other item is we're talking about this, and certainly, I mean, the local papers this morning are a prime example of this. It's being portrayed not as the United States and other countries and Iraq. We can talk about Russia. We can talk about France. We can talk about China. But we don't talk about the United States and Iraq. We talk about George Bush and Saddam Hussein, like it's only two men that matter. And in the case of George Bush, you know, we'll talk about this with the elections also. You know, granted, he's the figure that a lot of people focus on, but it's an entire administration full of people that are pushing for really very reckless policies here. But the real danger is in talking about Iraq interchangeably with Saddam Hussein, because if you go to war against the country of Iraq, Saddam Hussein is probably the last person who's going to be damaged in the attack. It's going to be the people who don't have access to, you know, 25 palaces and underground bomb shelters all the time. And talking about Iraq interchangeably with Saddam Hussein hides that truth. I think it's a very disturbing way to talk about this issue, and it's done constantly in our media here.
It also hides the fact that there's a government of Iraq that has already offered access to the inspections,
yes.
to the inspectors, unfettered access. And, I mean, you can look at this morning's newspapers and shake your head and say, what world do these people live in, the people who write these newspaper headlines? Because they have it portrayed as now it's up to Saddam to decide. When, if you've been paying any attention at all, you know that the Iraqi government
yeah.
has already offered access. I mean, there's no question that they're going to allow the inspectors in.
Yeah, and they're portraying it in the media coverage this morning in the papers as this is something that Iraq probably won't do. Well, Iraq has already said they're going to do it.
Yeah, so I don't understand why are you doing this? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. Except, of course, this is the way the Bush administration is spinning it, and that's where the press is taking its cue.
Well, and to me, then, if the whole thing with the Bush administration spinning it like this and paying lip service to a degree to now that they've got this passed, and certainly they aren't respecting any other treaties or things like this, it doesn't seem like a big step that they, now that they've got this, that they could then go to war at some point and use
yeah.
this as the excuse.
You're
that,
right.
Well, no, we had
yes.
UN support. I mean, just like the whole no-fly zone thing. I mean, that was never approved after, you know, the
yeah.
initial stuff.
You're right. I mean, and this administration in particular is well known for ripping up treaties and not paying any attention to their agreements and other commitments and just doing what they want. So it's very possible that even with this resolution in place, the U.S. could just go ahead and unilaterally declare war at the first at what they deem to be the first sign of resistance.
Yeah, the danger with that, and it's it's really, I think, one of the only hopes for the anti-war movement right now in terms of sort of keeping a damper on the Bush administration aggression, is that if the United States turns around and does that, then the various concessions that France and Russia have offered in order to for their political support to kick in also become endangered. And for example, we found out this past week through MSNBC that Russia turns out to have been much more key than has previously been announced in terms of the United States operations in Afghanistan, which, you know, we talk about Iraq a lot, but there's still a war going on in Afghanistan, and there's going to be for quite some time. The Karzai administration does not have control of most of the country there still, and it's getting worse, not better. Well, it turns out that troops and supplies and everything else to Afghanistan from the United States are being ferried almost entirely through Russia with the cooperation of the Russian military using the old Soviet rail system from the ports at Vladivostok and Murmansk and on the Pacific and the Baltic. That, number one, puts the United States in the league with, you know, yet another round of war criminals and thugs. We, you know, talked about the Moscow hostage crisis in Chechnya last week. But beyond that, you also have then Russia having an enormous point of leverage to keep the United States in check with what it does in Iraq, because if Russia decides it doesn't like what the United States is doing, the United States, you know, suddenly faces a possible loss of the kind of cooperation that it's getting right now with Afghanistan.
Well, I don't know. Just looking at the current administration, I could picture them thinking that's a fair trade-off.
Yeah, oh, very much so. I mean, you know, I mean, the whole idea that the war on terror has anything to do with actually stamping out terrorism is you know, receding ever farther into our collective memory hole, it seems like.
Seems to be being dug out to larger and larger sizes as we speak. Let's can we talk about the elections now?
Sure.
Anything
yeah.
else
sure.
on you?
Let's move on.
Since I know we've all been elated all week with the results. I mean, I'm finally coming down off that. So. Uh-huh.
Well, yeah, I really think the results were not encouraging, and that was true on a number of levels. I mean, my personal disappointment was seeing the huge amount of money the insurance industry poured into the universal health care measure in Oregon in the last couple of weeks, and a measure that was thought to be pretty close in the polls turned out to just get stomped. But and we'll get to our local coverage.
A clear illustration of how money can really influence.
Yeah. Very, very much so. I mean,
money, you know, and lots and lots and lots of advertising.
Yeah, there were several health insurance companies that each spent more than twice what the entire Yes campaign spent on that measure. But and we'll get to our local state measures and whatnot in a minute. But just nationally, the whole media spin of this was a massive sweep for the Republicans was really, I think, even more discouraging in some ways than the election results themselves. Yes, the Russians, the Republicans. Now you can. We warned you. We're tired. They have control of the Senate. Of course, they had control of the Senate after the elections in 2000. Also, this is not a new thing. We've seen now, I think, how it's been demonstrated much more clearly just how dangerous the Bush administration is, and there is clearly a lot of organizing work for progressives on the left to do, and a lot of defense that's going to be played over the next couple of years. That being said, you know, there were fewer than 10% of the congressional races in this country that were even competitive. Of those, only a few swung over. It was, you know, there weren't even that many
and
people.
Most of those were very close votes.
Most of those were very close votes. It was it was hardly a sweeping mandate. You have the dynamic that most local elections are decided on personalities and local issues. They're certainly not decided on, well, I'm going to vote for X because I want the Democrats, the Republicans to have control of the House or the Senate. You certainly don't vote as a mandate for war, which is another way that the election this week is being portrayed. And you have the whole dynamic of redistricting having taken place this past year after the every 10-year census. And because Republicans control many of the state legislatures in the Sun Belt where many of the seats were gained, you have have the dynamic of many of these districts being the new districts that were being drawn explicitly benefited Republicans. So, you know, in many ways, this was not a surprise at all. And yet, most of the media coverage that we got talked a lot about George Bush's popularity, about his coattails, about a mandate for war, a yada, 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 yada. It was nothing of the sort. And people don't vote that way.
Yeah, and it didn't focus on the fact that he marshaled a whole army of his own people in government to run the campaign. I mean, he had his own, he had Karl Rove in the White House vetting and selecting the candidates. That's how they how much they micromanage this whole campaign. And I mean, for people like me who've been wondering, what the heck is the Bush administration doing for the last 6 to 9 months? Because they hadn't been doing anything. This is what they've been doing.
Yeah,
they've been working really, 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 really hard to get Republican control of the House and Senate.
Yeah, this administration is all about power.
And
it
you
really is.
And you had Bush flying. During the weekend before the election, he visited 14 different states.
And,
in that weekend.
And a couple of additional things about that. There was a massive push also to use the types of fundraising that are now illegal under the campaign finance reform. Well, many of them only became illegal with this election this past week. So up until the final moment, they were raising money not just for this past election, but for the future as well. And you also had the dynamic. It was not just cabinet-level appointees that were campaigning for congressional candidates around the country. It wasn't just Bush himself. He was using virtually every political appointee in the federal government was getting, you know, time off with pay and being flown around in, you know, jets to different parts of the country to campaign for Republican candidates, to help out with logistics and organizing fundraising events and campaign rallies, to marshal volunteers. I mean, this was the sort of a massive sell-off of federal government facilities, in this case its workforce, that makes Clinton's renting out of the Lincoln bedroom look like child's play. And yet, really, the Washington Post was the only newspaper in the country, and none of the networks really did either that I could tell, that even began to pick up on this story. It was just ignored.
Yeah, and I want to remind folks, too, that even though the Republicans are going to have a majority in the House and in the Senate, that they don't have enough of a majority to block a filibuster. The Democrats can still block Republican bills by having one senator with the support of his party standing up and starting a filibuster, and it takes 60 votes to end a filibuster, and in the Senate, and the Republicans don't have that. So it's not. This is not a massive sweep by any means.
Yeah. That being said, I do want to remind folks in another direction also that the Democrats or the Republicans having control of the House or the Senate does, it certainly makes a difference, certainly in terms of federal appointees. We heard nothing on this past election cycle about the Supreme Court. You're going to have the U.S. Supreme Court hasn't had any changes in 8 years, and you have one justice in his 80s and two more in their 70s. It's the longest stretch without a change of the Supreme Court in modern history.
Those tires are getting pretty bald.
Yeah, there are a number of ways in which that's going to be problematic with Republican control of the Senate for the next 2 years. It's certainly a risk. But I have this debate with some of my colleagues at The Weekly quite a bit, because a lot of them are of the Nader bashing. He cost $2,000 and never say there's not a difference between the Democrats and the Republicans again, and yada, yada, yada. Well, one of the reasons that people were saying in 2000 that there was not a significant difference, not that there was no difference, but that the difference was essentially a wash, was that when the Republicans did bad things, you had some opposition from the Democrats, but when the Democrats, like Al Gore, did bad things, there was no real opposition. Well, one of the ways in which the Bush administration has turned out to be a disaster is that, of course, he not only surrounded himself with people who are venal, but they are in many cases extraordinarily venal. But another of the, and we had 9/11, which obviously nobody anticipated. But one of the other major differences is there hasn't been the opposition from most Democrats, certainly not the Democratic leadership. And I think having Nancy Pelosi heading the House caucus for the Democrats is very good news in that sense.
Did they decide that?
She's pretty much in now. Yeah, her competitor dropped out of the race, so that'll become official in a couple days. But, you know, people can't depend on the Democrats to stop the Bush juggernaut. We have to organize ourselves around it. We have to exercise leadership ourselves. We have to create a movement ourselves. And if the Democrats want to come along, or if they want to respond to that movement, as some of them did around the Iraq resolution debate, fine and well. But that should not be the object to influence or to reclaim Democrats. The object should be to create the movement. And you know, if the movement is there, then there's a chance that the Democrats will respond. If the movement is not there, then I think it's a little naive to expect that the Democrats are gonna offer principled opposition, particularly when many of the Democrats that are already running in 2004, you know, are to the right of Clinton. And people like Joe Lieberman or John Edwards, who are not about to challenge George Bush on much of his agenda.
Let's talk about some of the results that happened in the state. And locally, we got just under 10 minutes left.
Yeah, for the state of Washington, many of the races are still too close to call, but it's looking like the Democrats will have control of the House, and possibly the Republicans may gain a one-vote majority in the Senate, although that's still, it's coming down to one race in which they may have to do a recount in order to see whether the Republicans will have a one-vote majority or whether it will be tied 50-50 in the Senate. But this year, our state legislature has two major issues to deal with, basically the $2 billion hole in the budget and the fact that Referendum 51 did not pass the transportation package. So it's going to be the budget and it's going to be transportation issues. And if we have, as we have now, a Democratic governor who leans far to the right and gets most of his support from the business community, and we have a Democratic House, and we have a 50-50 tie or a Republican-controlled Senate, we're going to have another logjam where nothing gets done in relation to either of these two problems. There's very little that can be done, really, in regards to the budget except to raise taxes or to make cuts. And there's not much leeway in raising taxes when the voters have voted down most tax increases and actually voted to take away a lot of existing taxes, like the vehicle excise tax and other local option taxes.
And Gary Locke doesn't even put it on the table as an option in most of his budget proposals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and really the only thing that they could do, the right thing that they could do would be to talk about a state income tax. That's not coming.
Or to close some of the corporate loopholes and some of those taxes.
And that's not coming either. Or to raise the B&O tax, the tax on business, and that's not going to happen either. So they're talking about other things like raising increasing gambling, which is not a very fair way, nor is it going to plug a $2 billion hole in the budget. There's no way raising gambling is gonna do that. They're talking about maybe a 4-5% increase in the gas tax, or 4-5 cent increase in the gas tax. That's wildly unpopular. I don't know if it'll vote if there's a Republican majority in the Senate. I don't think it'll pass.
And parenthetically, on R-51, you can bet that when the legislature and the governor's office go back to consider what to do about transportation, because there will be another attempt to put a package together next year, they're going to take the anti-tax message from the vote. They're not going to take the environmental concerns. The reason a lot of people, certainly in this area, voted against R-51 was that it was so road-heavy and that the selection of projects that they did was so badly flawed. That won't sink in. What will sink in is that people didn't want to pay the gas tax.
Well, I don't know if that'll sink in or not. I mean, the people who are designing the regional transportation package are already learning some of the lessons from Referendum 51. They are actually picking up on the fact that people didn't want to vote for projects that weren't completely funded in that package. So they're looking now at a smaller number of projects that will be completely funded by the regional transportation package. They're also looking at the mix of how they're going to raise the funds to do that. they're tinkering with that a little bit to try to see if they can make some change that will be more palatable to voters.
Right.
And they're also looking at including some a role by the state auditor to review some of the projects, which would address the accountability question that people had with Referendum 51. So they are learning some of the lessons from the fact that Referendum 51 was voted down. I think the question is there's going to be pressure on the state legislature to pass a package itself and not put it before voters.
Yes.
That pressure existed with the last legislative session. And no, Democrats and Republicans decided no, and the Republicans really pushed for this, and the Democrats gave in that yes, we have to put the package in front of voters. That debate's going to go on now again this year, and it may take up a lot more time than it really has to. There's going to be pressure from the business community to say, no, don't put it in front of voters. And there's going to be pressure from the Republicans to say, yes, we have to put it in front of voters. And that's going to take up a lot of time.
Yeah. The other thing about the regional package, of course, is that it's being designed for the voters of the county region, as opposed to statewide voters. And that's going to be a very different dynamic also. People who are more willing to pay for some of these projects.
Because Referendum 51 did pass in King County.
Yes.
Just not statewide.
And 776 passed went down in King County and was the only place in the state where it did.
Yeah. So clearly people at least in King County want road improvements and are willing to pay for them. I think the question is, can the Tri-County area, because I believe Pierce County voted overwhelmingly against Referendum 51.
Yes, it did.
And I believe Snohomish County also voted Referendum 51 down. It's a question of, can King County prevail? Or I believe Dwight Pels on the King County Council would like to separate it so that it's not a tri-county package, but it's each county. I think that's going too far, but he would like to do that because he sees that in King County, people are willing to vote for it, whereas in other counties, they're not. So, yeah.
And it's looking like the monorail at this point is passing, but it's, of course,
it's still too close to call. There's so many absentee ballots that haven't been counted yet.
Yeah, and just the whole idea that we're doing all of these transportation projects piecemeal is still just really maddening to me, but...
All right, only have a few minutes left, and you wanted to give us a little update on what's going on at Eat the State.
Yeah, we have, and I should say parenthetically also, there were several people that emailed me on things from the radio show last week, and my email crashed a couple days ago, and I had read all the things in my inbox, but there were a number of things I hadn't had a chance to reply to. So if you haven't heard back from me, that's one of the reasons why.
Send them another one.
You might want to resend that email.
Send me another one.
Although you lost a bunch of your messages,
yeah,
too.
It's like there are about 2,000 in my inbox, and you know most of those were old ones that had been read. It wasn't that I'm getting 2,000 ads for penile implants every day, although it sometimes feels like it.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, Eat the State is having a potluck and social event and volunteer fair this afternoon, and the reason for that, aside from the fact that we just wanted to get people to get together and hang out, but also for people who listen to this show each week, Maria and I have been working on this little community project for several years now, and most of the core people who volunteer for this, we all have day jobs. None of us get paid. The layout person gets paid kind of a token amount for his professional work, but not nearly what he should be. A lot of his work is volunteer as well. And we need more people. One of the frustrations is that we actually do get people who call up or email and say they volunteer and want to volunteer, and some of those people haven't even had a chance to respond to because A, we don't have a volunteer coordinator, and B, we haven't...
That's our biggest need right
yeah,
now,
we
a volunteer
we haven't,
coordinator.
we haven't had the time because we're literally stretched so thin and just trying to get the paper out to sit down and collate, okay, these are the different routes, these are the things that need to be covered, and just sort of coordinate that. So this is
Distribution coordinator.
Yeah, for distribution and some other thing. The nitty-gritty of getting this sort of information out to the community. It's very popular when it gets out. It's very hard to find sometimes in print, particularly because of those sort of holes in our sort of whole production chain. But the reality is that many of the core people who have been working on this project have been doing it for 5 or 6 or 7 years. And, you know, there's a risk of burnout going on. And it's, you know, I don't want to be dramatic and sit here and say, you know, the paper is going to disappear if we don't get some of the folks who are listening to come in and help. But beyond getting together and having a chance to hang out, and we also have our monthly business meeting next Wednesday night for folks who can't come this afternoon, we really do need and want some new energy, and it's a very open process. So this afternoon, it's anytime between 1 and 5, stop on by in Wallingford. The address is 4302 Meridian. It's the corner of 43rd and Meridian. It's a big old house with a chain link fence around it. The phone number there, oh, let me give you a different number that folks can call if they want directions or other information. It's area code 206-719-6947. And then more generally, you can call the state's voicemail. It's area code 206-903-9461. And the paper is free, and you can find it around town each week and on the web.
All right, and it's a potluck too today, right?
So people can bring food. You don't have to bring food. People don't feel obligated. Like,
it's
I
more
can't
important
come
to bring your body.
I can't come because I didn't cook anything.
It's
I
more
can't
important
come
to come in and talk to
I
us.
I didn't have a chance to stop by the 7-Eleven and pick up some Doritos. Yeah, stop on by, and if you think to bring food or drink, great.
Yeah, and I'll be there, and Job will be there.
Yep.
All right. Okay, so...
We'll have our spiffy T-shirts, too, for anybody who wants any of those.
So you can bring $12 for that, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll talk to you both next week then.